Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Just getting over a little bit of a small virus, but not too bad. What about you?
Enjoying the good weather.
Yeah, it could be nice, couldn't it? It could get out. It's clouding over today, but it's nice to have a little bit of a summer, you know.
Yeah, it looks like we've had a bit of a summer this year. Makes a change.
It definitely does. There's just the two of us this week. No guest. So we decided we would talk about something that's come around as part of the work you do, Martin, part of the team that you support within the company you work for. And that's the idea of price parity between buying either hybrid or hard drive systems and or flash systems. And I think you mentioned that you were seeing a real price parity in those two platforms. And we just thought we'd discuss that today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly beginning to see more price parity, certainly in the high-end hard disk market, so 15K drives versus all-flash arrays. So it's interesting. I think we're beginning to get to that tipping point.
Okay, so let's set the scene a little bit, because obviously, there's been lots of things in the past that have said, oh, no, price declines on hard drives as much as it does on flash. And I think that's something that we talked to Jim Handy about at some stage. And that I think that's fairly true. The difficulty is, of course, we're seeing a sort of, as you pointed out, a bifurcation of the hard drive market, where we're going into the old capacity side of things and the high performance side of things. And it sounds to me like from your perspective, you're seeing the high performance stuff as the stuff that's effectively being pushed out.
Yeah, so 15K drives are still around, are still offered by all the major vendors. You don't see very much in the 10K range. And then you drop down to the nearline SAS, so 7.2Ks and 5.4, so the slower drives, so capacity drives. So I think we're beginning to see the performance drives in the hard disk market beginning to vanish. I'm not sure how many plants are still making them and whether there's actually a shortage of them. They also don't make an awful lot of sense.
There's an interesting part, the fact that just looking at the media, we used to have that high-end 15K stuff, the middle sort of performance 10K stuff, and at the bottom end, the capacity 7.2, 5.4. And really, the top-end stuff didn't really get a lot higher in terms of capacity, did it? We peaked at about, I think, at about 2 terabytes on those drives. So the fact that we can't get anything past that sort of capacity.
From a capacity point of view, Chris, I've not seen anything larger in the 15K market than a 600 gig drive. So that means that to make a reasonable amount of capacity based around hard disk for performance, you're going to need an awful lot of spindles.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you'd seen in terms of pricing. So when you're talking about pricing, are you saying the parity between the two platforms is on a raw basis? Is it to do with the TCO, or is it literally just the price of the platform when the vendor comes in and talks to you?
I'm seeing it on a raw basis. So you can buy, say, 10 terabytes of flash for pretty much the same price as you could buy 10 terabytes of 15K of drives. Certainly 300 gig. 600 gig spindles, probably still 10, 15% cheaper than flash. But there's a lot of hidden costs there as well. Certainly if you're running hard disks, certainly 15K hard drives, you've got a big power hit as well.
Yeah, and there's the thing. So I guess a lot of people will look at just the pure price of the array because that's the most obvious thing to do a comparison with. But in reality, you have to compare the cost of the actual chassis, the power, the cooling. You know, it may cost you a lot more to, for instance, rack something that's quite heavy. So you might have to have a lot more structured flooring and all that sort of stuff. So TCO, I think, can be quite relevant in that discussion.
Oh, yeah. So we were looking at some capacity recently, looking at doing some refresh of some arrays, and we could do an all-flash array in 2U, whereas if we were to stick with a hard disk array, it was between 6 and 8U. That's a big saving on rack space, even if you forget about the power.
Yeah. People say, oh, well, when you build your data center, you've built it. And that's true. You know, if you have got your own data center, you have built it, and it is there. The question is not when you've built it or the fact you've built it. It's the fact that as you get the data center more fully populated, you get to a point where you start looking for things you can actually replace, swap out to avoid extending that data center and making it any bigger and spending more money. So actually, when people think, oh, well, rack space doesn't matter because I've already built the data center, I think it actually does for that reason.
I think it absolutely does. Certainly, if you look in compute is becoming more power hungry. There is more memory you stick in a server, the more power it demands. So yeah, I really think you're right there. I mean, all the power savings we can get by moving to flash on storage will go straight into compute or even network.
Yeah, so do you see within the stuff that you're getting quotes for from vendors, do you see them including software in that now? Because there was a bit of a move towards all-inclusive software, wasn't there, compared to what they used to be when, say, 10 years ago, when you had 3,000 line items for software and various other components on your quote?
It does depend from and vary from vendor to vendor. I do see software being split out often. So when you buy an array, you'll have the software at one line and the hardware on a different line. Some array vendors are still offering bundles, or some want to individually line items. Both have advantages, both have disadvantages. But the most annoying thing is the software for bundles, Chris, is you often find yourself potentially paying for stuff you're not using. So as we move to a situation where one of my favourite subjects, replication, is we do less replication, software replication licenses you don't want, but in a lot of companies, their enterprise bundles include replication, and you don't really want it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when you look at software, you can sort of almost give the software away for nothing because there's no physical thing you've given. So I think it can be an emotive thing sometimes when they bundle software in and you think, oh, I'm paying for something I don't want. But they might just say, well, we just won't put it on the list, but that doesn't change the price. Because at the end of the day, the software exists. And sometimes I wonder whether vendors just think, well, we'll include it or we'll not include it, but we're not going to take, if we do take it out, we're not going to give you a huge amount of discount because of that.
I've also seen vendors begin still trying to charge for almost base functionality, but they're almost charging for firmware. And it's, hang on, that's not right, because without the firmware, you've just sold me a bunch of disk. So I think at times we need to look at what vendors are tying together. I'd like to see a much more standard package for hardware. Basic hardware, if you have an array, you should at least be able to present blocks out of it without paying any extra for another line item.
Yeah, agreed. So let's go back and talk about the pricing in a bit more detail and see if we can think about what Flash has done to help push that price lower and lower. And I think there was an interesting story, I think it was a Chris Miller article in the Register, talking about how the NAND flash makers' revenue will decline over the next couple of years rather than increase. However, we will be producing a lot more capacity because the price per bit, if you like, because of things like 3D NAND and TLC and QLC, will push that capacity up, but it'll be sold at a cheaper price. I just wonder whether that's going to have a big impact or not.
I'm not convinced the revenues from flash go down the same way as revenues from hard drives didn't go down for a long time. We have an inexhaustible hunger for storage capacity. So you may say the cost per bit falls, but both vendors are shipping a lot more bits. And I suspect they also get economics of scale. I suspect their profit margins may well actually be very similar.
I would imagine that as we move forward, price drop means you're shipping more. And I would have thought, well, actually, the constraint isn't necessarily around price particularly, but perhaps the ability to produce enough of the actual product itself. So, you know, actually having a factory scaled up to be able to produce enough NAND to be able to make it, to get the revenue in. Because obviously if you're producing that lower cost per bit NAND, then yes, you're shipping the same amount of product perhaps at a lower price, so therefore your revenue might go down. So I would have thought they were constrained by delivery and production rather than anything else.
I would agree on that. Production and production constraints are probably the one thing which actually means that prices stay relatively high or relatively good for flash. We've had Jim on a couple of times. We've talked about the Chinese coming into the market. And if we have a lot of capacity come out of China from Chinese fabs, I think we will see the price start to go down because it becomes a commodity resource. There's no constraint. It's just there.
Makes you wonder why they want to produce QLC and TLC then, if they get less money for the product compared to what they used to do with expensive SLC and MLC.
Because if they don't do it, somebody will.
Absolutely. And I think that's the problem, isn't it? You know, that is going to be part of the market, and that is part of the market, and has always been part of the market of storage, that prices will decline rapidly. So we shouldn't expect to see any change there. But if you remember in episode 44, I think it was, we talked about the 100 terabyte flash drive and whether that would have an impact. And I wonder whether, when we look at the top end size of hard drives as well, you talked about numbers of spindles, whether we'll see those devices having a real impact on price.
Yeah, I think we will. But I think from a storage point of view, it means that certainly these larger high-end devices or large devices in general, it means that we need to understand a lot more about our data and its life cycle. We know that QLC, and I imagine we'll end up going beyond at some point, it's a read workload, not a write workload. So that means that you're going to have different classes of storage. And we're never going to get away from tiering and moving data around.
There's an interesting question. So two things there. First of all, let's do one and then the other, and I'll try not to forget the second one. But first thing there, obviously tiering. Initially, I think people might have thought, oh, it's flash. Everything's flash. Everything's the same. It's just a single piece of solid state media. We don't ever need to tier again. And I always thought that was a bit of an odd thing to think, because as long as there was a good enough price parity between the different tiers of, or the different types of flash, you would always have an opportunity to tier. Obviously, if the price parity isn't very high, the overhead of actually moving data around becomes not worth it. But if there is a difference, then it's worth it. And I wonder whether, do you think we see enough differentiation between the different tiers of product to make it actually worthwhile?
I'm not sure what we do at the moment. I think we're at a weird plateau point where NVMe-based flash is pretty much the same price as SAS-connected flash in general. We certainly see that in consumer market. So I don't think we do at the moment, but I think as we see QLC and these bigger drives, which have different write cycles or different life cycles, I think we will see it again. And it doesn't really matter what you do. You're always going to have a tiering within your storage device. We know that because we have these things called caches.
That is true. There, I mean, obviously, we do tier already today. I tell you the reason I'm curious to try and think through which way it might go. And that's because when we look at the hard drive market, until recently, we didn't see the end of certain drive types. So we saw all of those different speeds and feeds we talked about earlier, and they all continue to exist in the marketplace. With flash, we've pretty much seen the vendors saying, and actually showing projections that say, that they moved away from SLC. They're almost implying they're moving away from MLC into TLC, and that will be the de facto standard. And you wonder whether they're going to say, well, we're going to do the same with QLC, because at some point we'll make it reliable enough to use just like we were using TLC or MLC. And actually, thinking back to when they brought TLC in, everybody was making or saying, oh, it's all going to be terrible because the lifetime of the product isn't going to be anywhere near as good as MLC. But it seems to have been adopted and just seems to work quite happily. As we see those products disappear from the market, does it mean there will be their capability to tier, because we might not even have them available to us?
It's true. We may find that the fabs are always switching to the latest version. But even then, Chris, if we think about what's going on elsewhere, so storage class memory, potentially that comes in, that will be different. So will we tier between storage class memory and flash-based devices? We might see things there, and there will be a cost difference. I think there will be a difference in price there. I don't see storage class memories getting anywhere near the size of the 100 terabyte flash drive, for instance, for quite some time.
Yeah, maybe QLC will be the point where we get to the situation where somebody says, well, we can't just keep moving to the next generation because this stuff isn't reliable enough. It can only be used for read-only workloads. And it is the actual first tipping point where we say, you know, it can't just be made to work just like all the other flash products have. And if that's the case, that goes back to what I was just going to say. This, the second point is that reliability thing. Do we honestly think that they'll say, okay, it's not very reliable today, but actually, do you know what? 3 or 4 years' time, once we've looked at the algorithms, once we've tweaked it a bit, actually we can make it as reliable as everything else.
That's possible. I think we'll see increased over-provisioning. So yeah, that's the interesting thing. As the cost per bit comes down, over-provisioning within the flash becomes much more viable. So you just over-provision to give you the reliability.
There's a little bit of a pushback there, isn't there? Yeah. Because as soon as you do that, you're not getting the what you think would be the price reduction. I'll explain what I mean by that. So when we went from TLC, which is 3 bits, we got QLC, which has got 4 bits. So we got theoretically a 33% increase in the capacity of the QLC device compared to the TLC device. Now, actually, in actual fact, when you look at the devices they've shipped, and Micron is a good example of that, their first device, the biggest capacity device, is only just under 8 terabytes.
Yeah.
That's no different from what you could get with a TLC. So in order, obviously what they've done is, as you said, they've A, over-provisioned, and B, the manufacturing process has been made bigger in order for them to get the reliability out of making the NAND in the first place. And then that reduces again. So obviously we don't initially see bigger capacities with QLC, and I'm not sure whether that translates initially into a big price parity either.
Probably not initially. I think as people get more comfortable and more confident about QLC, you're right, as experience will tell, so operational hours will become the important thing. I think, weirdly enough, historically, the flash market's been very conservative about the lifetime of some of their products. We know, for instance, within the consumer drives, within the Samsung drives, they're rated for one particular life cycle. I can't remember, I think Storage Review or something like that did a big long test or SSD review and showed that actually the life cycle for a Samsung drive was ridiculously high, way outside of its guaranteed lifetime. So for once in the industry, we have a situation where the vendors themselves are actually being overly conservative.
Yeah, I suspect there's a certain degree of learning and experience coming out of that, where they've looked at the products as they put them into the market and they've been deliberately conservative. But then as time's gone on and more devices are in the marketplace and they've been able to see the level of returns and everything else, I guess they've learned to work out whether they can actually put a more lengthy lifetime on those products. And that's possibly just simply by having a bigger mass market to be able to evaluate whether you're right or wrong about the lifetime of the product.
Yeah, also maybe a bit of marketing going on there as well. You may actually want the drives to have shorter life cycles or shorter official life cycles. Otherwise, you'll never sell any more of them.
That's an interesting angle that we started to see on hard drives a year or so ago. I wrote a blog post on it because some of the large capacity hard drives were starting to get quoted with terabytes written, you know, the lifetime amount of data you could write to the drives. So for whatever reason, either marketing, don't know, but perhaps just simply because the mechanics of writing and reading to those drives was just that much more complicated, they were putting a lifetime write guarantee on that drive, just like you're seeing with flash, which I thought was really quite interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if that's been driven by what's the big archive company which publishes hard disk reliability figures.
Oh yeah, the Backblaze stuff.
Yeah. So I wonder if the marketing is almost a reaction to that, because Backblaze are printing real world failure rates and real world, it says terabytes written. So if they don't use this, Backblaze are going to publish it anyway. They're doing all their own stuff, so it's all real world. So why not? I've certainly looked at the Backblaze figures. I've used it to drive some of my purchasing decisions, even at home, looking at reliability of drives. And I know I'm not buying thousands of them, so in some ways it's a bit of a nonsense because you always get the rogue drive which fails early. But you do look at it and think, oh, the 10 terabyte drives are really reliable. The 8 terabyte drives aren't so reliable. You know what? I'll spring for a 10 terabyte, get 2 terabytes of extra capacity. But I also have a more comfortable feeling, for instance, that that drive is more reliable.
I think that's a reasonable thing to think, though, because at the end of the day, you can guarantee that as they bring out bigger capacity drives, they've used some technique or other to add the capacity to that drive. And it may have been something that's physically increasing the size or changing the size of the bits, you know, actually on the disk. But then again, they may have used some other technique like overlaying, you know, the SMR type stuff. And inherently, some techniques might be slightly more or less reliable than others. So it's not an unreasonable thing to look at market stats and use that to sort of judge or make your purchasing decisions.
I noticed, I think, in the last round of Backblaze figures, they actually included some flash drives. So they're starting to look at flash themselves. So that'll be interesting to see if they adopt flash in a large scale. And then we'll start to get somebody who's a large user of flash publishing their figures who don't actually have an axe to grind as such. They're not selling an array or any particular device. They're just buying things as we do.
True.
And that will be very interesting to see, because they'll be almost, as far as I know, the only people, and they're probably not quite hyperscale, but let's call them hyperscale for sake of argument, the only hyperscale service provider who I believe is publishing reliability figures based on equipment that they use.
That's going to be really fascinating to see, because if we see mass adoption at that point, then that says somebody else has done the real calculation on the figures and said, we genuinely think we can make this work at scale, and therefore we're going to go for it. I mean, there are other issues there, like the fact that Backblaze deliberately produces stats that show many different drive manufacturers' capabilities, and you have to wonder whether there would be enough coverage for them in the market to be able to do something like that, or if at the moment, I think we've only got one QLC supplier in terms of actual drives. So, you know, they wouldn't have access to a range of devices if there was a shortage or there was other issues, which I think has hit them in the past, hasn't it? When they had the floods in Thailand, they were ripping drives out of portable USB drives.
Yeah, a fascinating company. At some point, we really ought to get them on, because they are fascinating how they do some of this stuff. Sometimes I think they've grown out of a bunch of cowboys, but now they really do know what they're doing, certainly from a commodity point of view. And they obviously spot buying hard drives. They're looking at the price of capacity and buying around price.
Yes, I think we should definitely get them on, Martin. I think they'd be an interesting guest. There's a lot of stuff they've learned, I guess, as you said, over that period of having developed their technology. So it'll be good to have a word with them, see if they'll come on. Yeah. I'll follow that one up. But getting back to the message in hand, you know, the whole idea of hard drive SSD parity. Do you think a flash first policy is sensible nowadays? Are we quite at that level yet, do you think?
I can't see why you wouldn't. I think you probably are a flash first for all your compute storage. Notice I make a big difference between compute storage and storage which you might be writing archive data or big data files. But for anything like a database or anything where you want to actually carry out lots of random access for it, certainly, I think you have to go flash first. I think it'd be crazy not to.
Yeah, okay. I think I would agree too. And that really sort of leads on to the question, and you were very careful to separate the different use types there, because clearly we're talking about flash for those high performance, transactional probably type workloads, or maybe even if you could afford it, sort of machine learning AI type stuff, if you could afford to do that with it as well. But I guess what we're separating is that sort of stuff from the long-term retention, maybe backup and cold archive, all that sort of stuff that can easily sit on hard drives. And that leads on to the next question really, and that's whether we see an ongoing point to have hybrid, because if we're going to have all flash at the high end, at the front end, if you like, and then at the back end, we just want to build out capacity. We're not going to put flash in that particularly unless we have a little bit of caching, perhaps. But I wonder where hybrid arrays have a future in this.
I think they do, but then again, I'm not quite sure where. I still see them, and every vendor pushes them. We still see a lot of vendors saying, well, buy a small amount of flash and a large amount of spinning rust, and we can give you the same performance as an all-flash. I'm not convinced for every workload. I think the beauty of going down the all-flash is you have a certain amount of comfort that you're going to get, well, hopefully, the same performance, whatever workload you throw at it. Hopefully, you won't see performance degrading. So we know that's potentially been an issue with some hybrid arrays. I won't name them, it's not fair, but we do know that people have said, oh, we loved them for the first 2 months, and then performance dropped off.
Yeah, but that's sort of inevitable because of the design, isn't it? Yeah. Because at the end of the day, there's always going to be the outlier IO you do that isn't on flash.
Yeah.
And you have to go to disk to get it. So you're always going to have that risk.
Yeah. So I'm not sure I can answer the question. I think there's still a market for hybrid arrays. So I think people still buy them. Do I think it's entirely wise? Depends whether you can get your vendor to sign up to some pretty heavy performance guarantees.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't do that, do they? A lot of people don't necessarily think that they can get the vendor to do that, that they should do. They should really try and push the vendor to make sure they get performance capacity guarantees that they expect. And that leads on to the next question, really, I guess. And that's this whole idea of translating your CapEx purchase into OPEX. You know, if you get into a price point where things are fairly similar, is it worth considering an OPEX solution rather than a CapEx one, where you can actually just go and do something like Pure's Evergreen? I think there's a number of other people who are doing a similar scheme, weren't they, with the Evergreen type thing where they replace the heads and all the rest of it. But obviously, the latest thing for Pure is this thing called ES2, which is like a rental, effectively, of the storage, and you don't own it. They own it, they manage it, and they put it in your data center. I wonder whether that is a way that we'll see more flash being adopted.
I think we will. I think more companies are beginning to look at their financial model. I think the OPEX CAPEX one is not a technical discussion. We know that. It's driven by finance departments. A lot of finance departments are very comfortable with capital expenditure as opposed to OPEX. I'm coming round to a feeling of OPEX. I think I can do some stuff with OPEX which I can't easily do with CAPEX. I can start associating costs of a service with OPEX a lot easier than I can with a CAPEX. So I can actually turn around to a line of business and say, by the way, your service costs this and here's your monthly bill. That's quite a powerful tool for driving efficiencies. It's much harder to do with CapEx.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. A good point that you're answering there in terms of that. And that's the way I've probably the only area I can see that I would be slightly happier with an OPEX versus CapEx is smoothing out those peaks and troughs of purchasing. And when you're converting your CapEx cost into an OPEX charge, you then resell to the business. That can become quite tricky to get right. You're spending a lot of time financially modeling all the different components, whereas if you already know that you're just putting a price that comes through, you don't have to think about overcapacity, undercapacity utilization, refresh. You know, you don't have to think about all those things as much. So I guess that's a really sort of positive move for it. So maybe that's where we might see more flash being adopted, simply because it's easier to buy at a smaller capacity without having to buy huge, enormous arrays. So, you know, other than say a minimum commit, that might actually help to drive that too.
It might also be easier in some ways from a management. So a lot of the issues with the OPEX model for purchasing storage in the past, whether it's a leasing model or capacity on demand model, is that although in theory it's elastic, once you've burst, it's actually very difficult to get back off again. So from a vendor's point of view, it's not very attractive because you'll suddenly find yourself on 500 spindles and then you'll end up with a big to and from, going to and fro with your customer. With a flash, it's probably easier to constrain. You just grow in. You're not growing across spindles. And it's probably actually more easy to actually do the building block approach as well. So just roll in with a bit more flash. Probably easier than doing it with a storage array. I don't know. I get the feeling it might be.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So just for anybody who hasn't really thought that through, I guess what you're saying is that if you look at the way that we purchased in the past, when we were buying an array, we would buy and build RAID groups, or we would stripe the data across many spindles to get the performance evened out. So your purchasing chunk, if you like, was always going to be based on however you'd laid that original array out to try and keep the performance consistent. And obviously you could build RAID groups and then add them to a stripe group, if you like, a pool, and that would help a little bit. But you could potentially be buying in certain chunks in order to get a consistent level of performance at the back end across your system. Whereas looking at a flash product, and as an example, I think Tintri did it just recently, God bless them, where you could actually just buy one drive at a time. And I think other vendors have done something similar, where, especially with the bladed architecture, you can just simply slot in another blade and everything just rebalances across it automatically, and then you carry on. So yeah, maybe that would help to drive that OPEX model a lot more easily because of that.
I just get feeling it might be more easy to evacuate data from flash as well. So on an elastic model, a vendor would turn up with some extra capacity on the hard drives. You'd put it in, you'd burst into it and say, actually, well, I don't need that anymore. Take it away, or just pull that capacity out. And you'd know as a customer that it was next to impossible for a storage vendor to remove disk from an array. It might be easier with flash.
Yeah, that's true too. Okay, so final question then, Martin. If you look across the industry, and actually I found something quite fun this week. It was 40 years since the first Intel x86 chip was released.
Yeah, we've got a special anniversary chip.
So if you look back to the original 8086, it was a 5 megahertz chip. The current one is a 5 gigahertz chip, this 8086K or whatever they're calling, i7 processor. The original one had about 29,000 transistors. They say that the new one will have something like 3 billion transistors. So from a processing perspective, we continue to follow Moore's law, and there's no reason to think we aren't going to do it in one way or another with multi-cores and all the rest of it. So I do wonder, getting to the actual question, I do wonder, can we afford not to go all flash? You know, are we in a position where if we don't go all flash, we're just basically like hobbling ourselves, you know, walking along with our legs tied together?
I think you are. I think you are with compute. If you actually were to look deep down at the life cycle or a lifecycle of a process or a transaction, the amount of time it's waiting for it to get back from storage is ridiculous. I think if we can start removing some of that latency, we'll drive much, much more performance out of our CPUs. That reduces costs. The environmental impact is a lot less. So I think in general, you can't afford not to go all flash.
Excellent. Okay. Well, on that note, I think we'll call it a wrap. Until next time. Thanks for that, Martin. Really, really useful, really good insights into the way you're doing stuff. Good. So if you want to catch us online, you've obviously, as always, you can catch us at storageunpacked.com, at storageunpacked on Twitter. And you can do a search for us on the LinkedIn group, and hopefully people will join and we can extend this conversation and see what everybody else thinks. Thanks for listening, and thanks, Martin.
Yep. Cheers, Chris.